From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
In the face of shifting weather patterns influenced by a changing climate, the garden can be a really confusing place these days. What stressors are coming next, and which plants will have the resilience required to stand up to whatever those prove to be? With no group of plants is that more essential environmentally to think about or trickier to figure out than with the trees. Because of their long lifespans, a tree planted today will be reaching maturity in what may be a whole different world. At Mount Cuba Center in Delaware, the esteemed native plant research site, a new effort called the Resilient Tree Canopy Project is underway to begin to think about tree choices for the future. Mount Cuba's Director of Horticulture, George Coombs, is here to talk about that work, so more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
George Coombs, who became director of horticulture at Mount Cuba Center in December 2018, was before that the manager of horticultural research, and he oversaw studies in its famed trial garden area where species and cultivars of native plants are tested for their performance side by side. He joins me today to talk about how the Mount Cuba team is beginning to assess native tree species for their roles in the landscape of the future. And I'm glad to welcome him back to the show after too long an absence. Hi, George. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. Any fall color there? I guess that's what we look to the trees for at this time of year.
Oh my gosh. It is like perfect fall color here right now. We've had such a dry, warm fall. I think that some of the best fall color I can remember here at Mount Cuba.
It's funny because I always, same up here in the Hudson Valley, I always thought that we needed moisture to have good fall color, but it seems like stress, drought stress, has brought out the wildest colors in the trees.
And you know what? We were talking the other day that it's just the fact that maybe the leaves haven't fallen off quite as quickly because the rain hasn't come around to knock them off. So there's
right.
Maybe more hanging on.
Maybe. Who knows? But I enjoy, in a world of madness, I enjoyed the colorful show we've been having recently, you know,
yeah.
as a respite, right, from all the madness. So, so the matter of kind of which trees will make it, which trees, you know, will make up our forest canopy and understory in 20 or 50 years and beyond, it's one I'm hearing more about lately, you know, from various people I interview, like Jeff Lynch at Wethersfield, a historic estate in Connecticut, Daniel Whitehush at Cornell Botanic Gardens, experts at Arnold Arboretum. I mean, they've all talked to me recently about thinking about this. So how did this become the topic of a project at Mount Cuba and when? Give us a little quick history of that.
Yeah, so at Mount Cuba Center, our garden's a little unique in that much of what we call the naturalistic gardens, which is the bulk of our gardens here, is developed from an abandoned cornfield. And so a lot of the trees that we have as our existing kind of mature canopy germinated in this abandoned field around the same time. And so we have this predominantly like tulip poplar canopy. These trees are about 100 years old now, which is kind of like the expected lifespan of a tulip poplar when that's maybe not what would kind of live forever on this type of site.
Mm.
And so we're finding ourselves with a kind of rapidly aging canopy, and we historically have not done a great job of kind of allowing new trees to kind of regenerate underneath of this canopy, kind of the next generation waiting in the wings. And so we recognized, several years ago that we really needed to do a lot more tree planting. However, I think, you know, kind of to what you're talking about with other folks is just the trees that we plant today are going to be alive, living through and alive, you know, kind of at the end of the century, hopefully, which is going to be a very different climate. And so we just want to make sure that we're planting the right things so that this kind of canopy that kind of shades this like beautiful garden that we have kind of remains healthy and intact, and we're not kind of setting ourselves up for future failures as we go about trying to kind of prevent one from happening, right now.
Right, and there's no guidebook.
There
We
is
can't
not.
just we can't look at the reference book. And I mean, I think gardeners listening, a lot of us were they remember, like, so it was like about a year ago, last November, we were a lot of us were reclassified into warmer zones or half warmer zones, USDA hardiness zones. And it kind of felt like that made sense. People were like, oh yeah, that's right, the dahlias I forgot to dig up came back for the first time. They overwintered, or the perennial plants that were sort of iffy ones or zone stretching ones were being marketed now in local garden centers and are doing well in my garden, that kind of thing. But it's more than that, in the matter of looking ahead to, say, the year 2100 or even 2050, and especially with trees, is more complicated. And it's not just temperature shifts and frost dates and literal hardiness of a particular plant and all its parts, but it's about what the shift in climate does to trigger more pests and diseases too, to give an advantage to their opponents. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other aspect to all of this, Margaret, is really just there are so many threats for our like native trees and not just kind of in natural forest communities or things, but in horticulture. We use a lot of like native tree species in horticulture. And there's, you've seen things with emerald ash borer, beech leaf disease. There's all kinds of these like what I would call like species catastrophic diseases that
Yes.
really, are going to change the way that our landscape looks and exists, and the types of, animal interactions that these trees provide for the wildlife. So there's just a significant amount of change in that realm. And then when you add on to it this like climate change, and there's so much that's unknown about that and to what extent we'll experience, but it's just kind of really stacking the deck against our trees in a way that we really need to be careful about what we may have been kind of just playing things fast and loose with species selections and where we put them and all of those things. I think it's going to have to get a lot more dialed in
Yeah.
to kind of avoid these like large scale kind of failures.
Yeah. So you have at Mount Cuba a long history of research, your trial garden programs, like I mentioned in the introduction, but you can't evaluate trees in like a 3 year or 5 year garden planting, row, plant rows of them and keep your eye on them and watch this one versus that one. You can't do that like you might a herbaceous plant, a perennial or an annual or even a biennial or whatever. You can't do that with trees. So what's the the methodology here? Because this is a different beast.
That's just it. It's one of those things like we will never have like the perfect answer, because by the time that we actually know, it'll be too late, right? We kind of have to like make
Right.
our best guesses now and hope that we're kind of being as informed as we possibly can.
And
So
yeah, so you're using current data and data from other places that are warmer than you, or where are you getting where are you kind of getting any insights that you might utilize? It's
yeah.
yeah.
So when we started this project, I think the most like well-known source, and rightfully so, is the U.S. Forest Service. They have a really very cool tool called the Tree Atlas, and this website provides a lot of information about how the Forest Service is modeling how different species will react to climate change. So you can go on there and kind of pick out any kind of typical native species that you might see in the woods around you, and kind of look at different models based on the kind of projected warming of this species might shift, 100 miles to the north, or it might just kind of expand in general. And so we started there. And when we started really kind of like digging into that data, it really was kind of throwing off some red flags for us, at least from a horticultural standpoint, because some of the things that they were recommending didn't really kind of follow logically. And so the more that we like educated ourselves about their system, it became clear that they were modeling all of these kind of recommendations that they were providing on how a species would perform in nature. So not necessarily in a horticultural setting, in a kind of person-made environment,
Right.
but it's really about how that species would shift. So it
So
depends
like a
a lot on.
self-sown seedling of whatever, like the next generation in a forest setting or something is that they might be thinking about, yes.
Yeah, like how many seeds does it produce? How is that seed distributed? How many plants currently exist in that type of forest in the region? All of those things. And so obviously we're kind of a lot more controlled and can choose things to put into our gardens that maybe wouldn't naturally like seed themselves into our area. So that was kind of the main shortcoming there. So we looked at another tool that was a little bit more of like a horticultural perspective, and that's something called the BGCI climate assessment tool. And BGCI stands for Botanic Gardens Conservation International, which is really an organization that compiles a lot of records that public gardens maintain individually and kind of puts it into one data set. And so they're looking at, you can kind of go to this website, the climate tool website, and like plug in a public garden near you, and it'll tell you, like depending on the warming model, like what the future climate is expected to be. And then it uses that information to say, okay, well, we know that public gardens at these temperatures are growing these species. So we have kind of a general like temperature range that we can provide you for a species. And they also have that information for like naturally existing examples. So it's a huge data set, and with all of this information, they're kind of able to give you like guidelines or boundaries of at these temperatures, you'll see this plant growing in nature, and then it'll give you kind of horticultural temperature ranges too. And so it's really interesting to look at that because they're not always the same. There's plenty of plants that will grow in warmer or cooler places than where they naturally grow. And that's like an important thing for everybody to keep in mind because plants, one of like the best things that I learned in college is plants grow where they compete best. It's not necessarily they grow where they thrive the most or kind of what they can tolerate. It's really about where they kind of carve out this like ecological competitive niche. And so there's gaps in our understanding about just how much you can push plants outside of where they naturally would occur. So some of this like
Competitiveness, yeah.
horticultural like data set is really helpful in kind of picking at that a little bit.
And then I think I read in the sort of a document that you gave me that's about kind of what you've thought about so far and done so far with this project, that you also looked at something called, I think it's Future Urban Climate Web Application. Did you also, where it kind of tells you what is thought to be the future climate in certain areas, like what's going to happen, the sort of predictions.
Yeah, I think that website needs a disclaimer. It can be a little scary to check
I'd
it
say
out.
so. My goodness, I thought I needed to take like a sedative after I read
Yeah, but
that.
it's a really cool tool, and I think it's a great way for people to kind of wrap their head around what like level of change is possible. And so this tool basically says you can pick any city near you. I picked a couple of different ones, Philadelphia, Dover, Delaware, etc. And it'll give you in a moderate warming scenario what kind of other part of the country you would be most like. So for example, like if you look at Philadelphia in a moderate warming scenario, Philadelphia will be more like a city in southern Maryland. But in a high warming scenario, Philadelphia could expect it to be more like Memphis, Tennessee.
That put me over the edge, George. That was a
Yeah, it's
lot.
wild.
That
And
was a
the
lot. But I think in a way it brings to front of mind exactly why we need to be thinking about this for our longest lived creatures and this how essential this is, because this is where it very well may be headed or possibly is headed.
And the bad news is like I built this report or this kind of analysis on the analogs this web tool was providing a couple of years ago, and I recently revisited it, and it's not being revised for the better. So it's like the more that the further in time we get, the more we understand where we will or will not be able to kind of hit this climate target. And it's going to keep shifting, is my point.
So those are some of the, so you looked for data that's out there of different types and analyses that are out there of different types, and you're sort of taking all that into consideration. And again, this is specific to your location, and this another entity, another organization might be doing this for their area. Are you also taking into, because you're talking about in a human-made setting, as you said, using these trees, are there also cultural practices or any other shifts in the way you grow the trees or plant the tree? I don't know that you're thinking of to give them better chances. Is that part of the analysis? I don't know.
It is and it isn't. So we're very interested in this idea. Well, let me back up. So all of this data is based on like yearly average temperatures, right? Which all climate like modeling information is based on this kind of yearly average temperature, which is a helpful metric, but it's not exactly like what plants experience, right? They live and die at those extreme moments where either it gets like really cold or it gets like really hot. And so you could have a mild increase in yearly average temperature and assume everything's going to be fine. But what could actually happen is like both of the extremes expand, or you get very kind of erratic from year to year or month to month temperature swings or kind of weather swings. And all that is like adding an extra layer of stress. And so, in terms of like thinking about the horticultural aspects of like how we plant these trees and where we want to put them, it just becomes all that more important to make sure that we're siting them in ways that they are going to kind of be able to weather those stressful moments as best as possible.
And we've, as gardeners, we've always really, well, we should have always really been thinking about it. It's almost like you're talking about microclimate in a way, or hinting at that kind of thoughtful process of like, okay, where am I placing this in this property that I'm managing or whatever? It's not, the north side and the south side and the out in the field versus, downhill, uphill. Those are not all the same places, even though they're on your quote property or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. When you look at like a natural like forest community on a hillside, there will be very different types of tree species on the south side than there are on the west side, or the east side, and it's very much different than the north side. And all of that has to do with, the kind of the microclimates of it gets more sun during the hottest parts of the day, so the plant is under more like water stress, and different types of trees are better at dealing with those stresses. And so that's like a level of detail that we're not used to really thinking about in horticulture. But we probably need to start kind of getting that specific.
So you in this kind of, again, it's not a report, but like the beginning of the notes on what you're doing that you shared with me, you have some like charts of species of trees, and some are like assessed by level, so to speak, using some of this data that we've just been talking about. And some that are kind of no concern, you're rating them as no concern, and some that are avoid, level four, avoid, avoid. There's a red light going off, and a warning beeper or something, I think. Were you surprised by who ends up on what list? And sort of, can you tell us a little bit about that, how that happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think no, I wasn't surprised. It was actually kind of reassuring, and honestly, I think the moral of this like this story or this project was there's a lot of native trees that are going to do well. A lot of the things that are already in our area, we expect to continue to be here. So that was like honestly a bit of a relief. So that was really great to see. And I think for us, some like really common species that we expect to do well would be things like red maple, sweet gum, tula poplar, white oak, sycamores. These are like large dominant trees in our landscapes, in our natural areas.
I saw Eastern Red Cedar, the Juniperus virginiana was on there, and
Yep, flowering dogwood, all of these things. Yeah.
So familiar mainstays of the native landscape. So it wasn't that they were all banished, so to speak, for their lack of resilience in this early analysis.
Yeah, and I think we kind of have like different tiers of like confidence. So like those like that first level, what we call like level one, we don't really expect them to kind of have any issues, even if we get to this like high warming scenario, which when you read more about that, it's a little scary. And then we kind of have ones that are a little bit on this kind of like gray area. We call them level two. They're likely to be fine, and so those are plants like sugar maple, cucumber magnolia, chestnut oak. These are plants that, for the most part, we think that they'll be good, but if we get to this high warming, they may start to kind of develop some stress and struggle a little bit.
Well, and like something like the sugar maple, it's been thought for a long time that yes, it may survive, but no, it's not going to be a maple sugar resource. It's not going to perform the same way in terms of its the way that we think of it as this source of this resource that we utilize. Do you know what I mean?
I
It's
do. Yeah, people
yeah.
often talk about sugar maples like disappearing, and our like work and analysis didn't really show that. I could see
Right.
maybe the forest that is dominated by sugar maple will look different.
Right.
But as a tree species, it seems like it would probably do well here for the most part.
Right. Right.
And
Yeah.
then as we get like kind of further down the levels, things start to get, a little bit more dicey where we feel like, okay, there's a couple of things that are going to be really stressed if we do get to that high warming environment. If it stays moderate, they're probably not going to be as much in jeopardy. And so those are plants that we would still want to use, but we'd want to pay attention to them and just see how they're performing and make sure that like our assumptions are panning out. And so some things there are like swamp white oak, yellow buckeye, butternut, which is a type of juglans. So there's a handful of things that we're like, yeah, we'll use them, but we're going to use them sparingly. And then kind of below that, that's when we kind of get to this like category of trees that we want to avoid. Again, it's not that we would never plant them. I think some of these plants do provide, different kind of ecological value to different insects and things that we want to have in our garden. But we just want to be very thoughtful about where we put them, that they're not going to, if they do start to struggle, they're not going to kind of pose like a safety hazard to any of our guests, or make sure that the we're not using them in kind of large concentrations where if they were to fail, it would really kind of be a big detriment to the garden.
Right. We have maybe 3, 4 minutes left, and so I was, of course, I'm looking through the list, even though I'm in a completely different zone. I'm looking through the list of familiar species to me, and I wasn't really that surprised that I saw some of the things, like for instance, the what I call moosewood, Acer pennsylvanicum. I think is that striped maple? Do you call it, or also, I don't know what the common
We
names
call it
are.
moosewood too, yeah.
Moosewood, okay. And so for me, that's like sort of right inside the forest edge here. It's an understory tree. It's very, very common, but it likes that cozy place where it's moister, where it's shadier, et cetera. And if I can't imagine it dealing with hotter, drier. Do you know what I mean? Its niche is could be made rendered inhospitable.
Yeah, and I think
Yeah.
it's interesting because we actually just planted like a garden that has this as a very dominant feature before we like did this project, and we're like kind of excited about that because we're going to be able to kind of monitor these trees very closely and see like are they starting to struggle? If they are, like what are they struggling with? Are they getting pests and diseases more often? Are they dying in droughts? Are they just kind of unable to handle the heat and kind of wither, in the hotter months. It'll just be very interesting to kind of watch these trees and their journey, knowing that they're already there. We're not going to like remove them by choice, but we'll be able to kind of watch their potential decline.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if in your forest their beeches are a big element, but they are here where I am, the native beech, I mean. And there's so much pressure on beeches, and it's just unimaginable what it would be, the forest would be without the beeches. Do you know what I mean?
It's frightening. It really
Yeah.
is.
So there are some species like that that I was just shocked, horrified, whatever. And again, I've heard about this from like the person at Wethersfield, the garden in historic garden in Connecticut, where that's a big part of both their ornamental with the European species of beeches, as well as their native surrounding forest lands, of which they have hundreds of acres. That's really, really scary stuff. I don't know. So I want to make sure we have time to just talk about you, something about sort of Mount Cuba. You have how many visitors come a year now, and so forth? It's growing, 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 I think. Yes.
It is growing. We're getting close to almost 30,000 visitors a year. Yep.
And you're open like April to November, I think. Is that right? Do I
We
make it?
open April 1st and we're open through the weekend preceding Thanksgiving.
And one thing that people may not know about, but people listening might want to explore. Your educational offerings are just incredible. There's, you have some incredible virtual as well as in person. And speaking of the topic of trees that we've been speaking of, I know in February you're going to be doing with a colleague, I believe, a presentation about some of this. So maybe you just want to, and it's part of a three webinar series, I think.
So we have a winter lecture series that we do every winter, starting in January. There's a talk, and then there's one in February, and then another in March. And they all are kind of typically tied together with a theme. And so the theme that we're going to have this year is just climate change in general. So Nicole and I, Nicole's one of our arborists here. We're going to be talking about this tree canopy project in greater detail on February 19th. So we're on the February time slot, but there's other kind of talks in this lecture series that people can watch. It's all virtual, it's all online, and it's you know, a really easy way to kind of learn about some of the work that we're doing and some other things kind of related to climate change as we think about, you know, what do our gardens need to be doing differently as we navigate that.
Well, George Coombs, I'm always so glad to speak to you. And like I said, it's been too long, but thank you. And I'll give the link to that series as well as to all the other educational offerings, because it really is quite the lineup of great speakers, great presenters, and great topics for all kinds of gardening. So thank you. Thanks for making time today.
Thanks, Margaret.
Okay, talk to you again soon. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Walcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.